Hello and welcome back to America Weekend. I'm Valerie Smaldone. It's great to have you with us. Clara Bingham is a former Newsweek White House correspondent, and her writing has appeared in Vanity Fair, Vogue, The Washington Monthly, and many other publications. She produced the documentary The Last Mountain, and her latest book, Witness to the Revolution, is a firsthand narrative of the period of time from August 1969 to August 1970, which was a time of great upheaval in American history. Clara, welcome to America Weekend.
Thanks for having me, Valerie.
So 1 year, August 69 to 70, just 1 year, but so much happened during that time. Can you, let's go through the history of those 12 months. Let's just do an overview of the things that happened in that 1 year of time.
Okay. It was just jam-packed with amazing events, events to celebrate and a lot of tragic ones as well. I start the book in August of 69 with Woodstock, which, as we all know, was a massive convening of young hippies celebrating the counterculture. 33 bands played. It went for 3 days. 500,000 people turned up, which was many, many more than expected. Also in that month, Daniel Ellsberg went to a peace conference, and after listening to a young resistor named Randy Keeler talk about why he was going to go to jail to resist the draft, Ellsberg decided to start Xeroxing the Pentagon Papers. Mm-hmm. In September, it was the beginning of the Chicago 8 trial, which was considered the trial of the century. A group of 8 anti-war activists were on trial in Chicago for the demonstrations in the 1968 Democratic Convention. This was hugely sensational. Also in Chicago, in early October, the Weathermen, who were a group of radicals who'd broken off from the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, staged their first big militant protest called the Days of Rage, where they were quite violent and fought the Chicago police. Many of them were arrested. There were a lot of injuries. Then by mid-October, there was the moratorium against the Vietnam War. And that, where 2 million people went on strike all across the country. And this was very significant because it proved that the anti-war movement by late 1969 was no longer just relegated to the radical fringe, that many people in mainstream America were against the war. November 3rd, right after that moratorium, Nixon gave his famous silent majority speech. And then just 2 weeks later, there was another moratorium against the war where 500,000 protesters stormed on Washington, D.C. for 3 days. That was one of the more, largest anti-war protests. And then just at that same time, on November 13th, the My Lai massacre was exposed by investigative journalist Cy Hirsch. And that was a terrible story of American soldiers who killed over 500 civilian villagers in Vietnam, many of them women and children. And it really played a pivotal role in turning even, more Americans against the war.
Having you do this in an oral history is astounding, listening to all the upheaval that went on. Sometimes when you're living through it, you're not aware, but it was astounding.
It really was. And just even in early December, Fred Hampton, who was a charismatic young Black Panther leader, was murdered along with his colleague Mark Clark in Chicago by the Chicago police, and we later learned the FBI, in what was really a cold-blooded assassination. This also was a very key event which turned the weathermen even more militant, and a lot of white anti-war groups felt that they needed to side with the Panthers, who were being very clearly targeted by the FBI, and so ratcheted up the response in a violent way. Also in December was Altamont, which was a disaster. It was supposed to be the Woodstock of the West, and the Rolling Stones played along with other bands, but the Hell's Angels were their security, which was not a good idea, and one man was killed by the Angels in a scuffle. By March, early March 6th, the weathermen had a mistake explosion. They were building a bomb in a townhouse in the West Village in New York on 11th Street. And by mistake, the bomb detonated and destroyed the entire building, killing three of the members of the Weather. They later became known as the Weather Underground, as the rest of the organization had to flee from the police. That was actually a very devastating event. Then May 1st, President Nixon announced that that America was invading Cambodia. It was called an incursion, but in fact, we had been bombing secretly Cambodia for a year leading up to this, but now there were going to be troops on the ground. And this announcement infuriated everyone who was against the war, who saw this more as an expansion of the war. And so students all over the country protested, including at a college in Ohio called Kent State.
Right. And we know the tragedy that occurred there. And this is just a piece of what is between the covers of Witness to the Revolution, Clara Bingham. As you went through this and you interviewed hundreds of people who were there, what did you take away as a writer, as a journalist, as an observer from this tremendous turmoil?
That's a good question. I took away a lot, but I think if I had to boil it down, I took away that the 60s as a decade, and obviously I look at the 60s through the lens of this one year, because everyone who I interviewed, of course, was shaped earlier on in the decade. And so I saw this year as the crescendo, in a way, of the 60s. The 60s was an incredibly important formative period of time, especially the late 60s, time of my book, and that it changed who we are as a country. In many, many profound ways, and that the most lasting ways that it changed us were culturally, and that there were really, the reason why I focused on this one year was it was a perfect storm of rebellion, and it was a time when both the civil rights movement, the counterculture, and the anti-war movement all came together. And there was an explosion of tumult and change. And after the, you know, after the dust settled later into the 70s and 80s, I think the takeaway that most of the people I interviewed agreed with was that they won the cultural struggles and lost the political struggles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We could say that we are in a bit of a turmoil now in the country, as we see so much violence and we see so much division in the country. Are we replicating this period in a different way now?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that we currently are very haunted by the 60s, and that in some ways, the Bernie Sanders, you know, revolution, as he calls it, the political revolution that he wants to bring, or and that his followers want him to bring, is really following up on unfinished business of the 60s. That many of the people I interviewed said, well, we didn't understand power then. We didn't understand how to actually make the changes in Congress and in the corporate structure of America that needed to be changed in order to reach our ideals of equity, fairness, justice. And so I really see the Bernie Sanders campaign as a follow-up of the 60s. And then on the dark side, I think there are some similarities between Trump and Nixon. Trump uses the phrase silent majority on many of his campaign signs. And that phrase was a lightning rod in November 3rd of 1969, because Nixon was essentially telling Americans, don't listen to the crazy hippies, mm-hmm. stick with me. And he encouraged violence against the anti-war left. After that speech, there was something called the Hard Hat Rebellion in May, where 200 construction workers beat up a group of protesters who were protesting in New York City after Kent State. And the police just let it happen, and 70 people were sent to the hospital. It was very violent and ugly and bloody, and Nixon invited them all to the White House to congratulate them afterwards. So that reminded me that, like, kind of taking advantage of those divisions and adding fuel to the fire, essentially, is something that Trump obviously is doing to the nth degree, and it reminds me, it comes out of the Nixon playbook.
It's a fascinating book. It's called Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Great, great investigative journalism. Clara Bingham, thank you for joining us on America Weekend.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Valerie Smaldone on the Envision Radio Network.
Now, cheap psych tricks with Dr. Buff.
And Dr. Buff here. Work to do. Appointing a committee. Is there a perfect committee size? Here's the social science of it. Common sense would suggest that the more people on a committee, the impact of the committee would increase. Maybe not. Here's the problem. It's called the law of diminishing returns. The more people added to a group, the greater the likelihood that more and more people will conform to the majority choice too soon. People may defer to the majority opinion and just stop thinking individually. What's the cheap psychological trick? The ideal committee size may be just 3, 4, or 5 people. Add many more than that, and people may be intimidated and not express an opinion that's different from the majority of the group. As a result, they just go along, and even better ideas never make it to the table. Got a question? Contact me at drbuff.com.
Don't complain about your cable bill going up and up and up. Do something about it. Grab a pencil and jot down this special number.
Call 888-359-MYTV.
Order in the court.
This is attorney Jay Coleman with the final verdict. Recently, Jack was diagnosed with narcolepsy after falling asleep at the wheel and crashing into a streetlight. Narcolepsy is a sleep disorder which can cause a person to fall asleep at inappropriate times. Since Jack now has medication for his disorder, he's decided to keep driving. But isn't this dangerous? Legally, is a narcoleptic even allowed to drive? The final verdict after this.
Just because you don't have time to read a book doesn't mean you can't enjoy stories about artists and groups that you love. To discover a whole new world of audiobooks and hear the stories that made the music, visit happylandaudio.com. That's happylandaudio.com.
If a doctor has prescribed medication to correct a disorder, then the state views the disorder as corrected. In this case, even a narcoleptic can legally drive. And that's the final verdict.